history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to a special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, you better believe there are heroes around you, and we have the privilege of meeting them each week here on the radio. According to the VA, there are roughly 20 million veterans living in America today. Only about 600,000 of them now represent that World War II generation that we hear from each week. I trust you're taking time out to say thank you to all the veterans you know this weekend. And chances are, you have members of your own family who've served in our armed forces. In my case, I get to thank my mother for the time she spent as an Army nurse, my uncle for his years as an Air Force pilot. I reflect on my late grandfather, a decorated Army doctor, whose story inspired my work with World War II veterans. His brother was wounded in Germany during World War II, and their uncle was a pioneering pilot who died in his airplane in World War I. I'm very proud of the legacy of service in my family, but I'm wondering, do the veterans in your family know how proud you are of them? Veterans Day is your opportunity to make sure they do, and in preparing for this week's show, reflecting on some of the incredible stories we've been fortunate enough to hear this year, I realized we very rarely have the chance to go back and share updates, encouraging developments that have occurred in these veterans' lives after we've had the privilege of meeting them here. So that's what's on the agenda today. We're going to hear some snippets from their original interviews, and remember, you can always find those in their entirety at hometownheroesradio.com. But then in each case, we'll have something new to tell you about, honors they've received, questions that were still unanswered at the time of the interview but have since been settled. You get the idea. And we're going to start with a man who was there when World War II began for America. Nebraska native Don Stratton, now living in Colorado Springs, Colorado, was aboard the USS Arizona on the morning of December 7th, 1941.
My battle station was a sight setter in the port anti-aircraft guns on the port side, and that was up about 55, 60 feet in the air on a tripod mast on the foremast.
And people hear you say that, and maybe some of them have already read your book, All the Gallant Men, or they've seen one of your interviews or heard you before. They saw you at Pearl on the 75th anniversary. But when people imagine that morning and they think about you being in that position, that many feet in the air with these Japanese planes coming in and bombs dropping, I'm sure they say, how in the world did you survive? You ever wonder that yourself?
Well, it had to be a lot of to do with the good Lord, I guess. But we were kind of trapped up there. We got out of the director and on the deck there, and the vessel was alongside a repair ship, and we got a hold of a seaman there that threw us a heaving line with that's a line with a lead on the end to stretch it out, and a small line, and then he added a big, heavier line, and we pulled that across, and we tied it off on the Arizona, and we started hand over hand across it, and we were already burnt. I was burnt like over 60% of my body, I guess, at that time.
How did that occur? You were in that position on the foremast when the big explosion happened?
The bomb that hit on the starboard side behind number two turret went into a million pounds of ammunition and it blew up. That just was a fireball that just engulfed us up there where we were at, and no way to escape or get off. So until we got the line there to go hand over hand across, we were kind of just stymied up there, and we finally got off. Six of us went across there, and only two of us alive today.
Yeah, I know you're not into getting all syrupy and sappy, but I'm just trying to imagine what those moments were like when you're engulfed in flames and your flesh is burning and you're trapped and you can't go anywhere. What do you do?
You're just trying to get out away from the flames and thinking about how the hell am I going to get out of here.
So if that seaman hadn't had that idea to tie that line.
Well, we kind of indicated that we wanted to get off of there, and he throwed us a heaving line, which is a small line, and then tied on the heavier line, and it's about probably 65, 70 feet across there, and we had to go hand over hand across there.
So already you said 60%+ of your body had been burned. So is that upper body, lower body?
Well, the whole body, everything.
But your hands were okay?
My hands were burnt I don't even have any fingerprints.
Well, was that from the explosion or was that from going down that line?
That was both.
So your hands are burnt, and then you have to hold on to a line or else you're going to fall to your death.
Right.
With hands that are already burnt, and I can't imagine what that feels like, the pain that you must have been experiencing. Or did the adrenaline take over?
Well, it's just self-preservation.
So you get down to that other ship, the Vestal, which is next to the Arizona. I've interviewed a couple guys who were on that ship, and they've described what your ship looked like. But once you got aboard on the Vestal, there's still a lot going on, probably. What did you see from there?
Well, we stood around there for quite a while. The Vestal was busy with firing their guns and whatever and trying to get away from the side of the Arizona and the explosion. And they finally got us in the shore boat and took us to the beach, and they picked us up in an open-air truck and took us to the hospital.
And how long were you in the hospital?
A year.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Wasn't quite that long. It was like till the next September.
And I'm sure, well, I've read some of your story. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to understand how you experienced it. So very few people alive experienced what you experienced. You're in all this pain, and you know you're going to recover. But was it a daily basis in those days that followed that you were learning of other guys that you knew from the ship who didn't make it?
Well, we most certainly figured that, but there was a few ex-sailors in the hospital with us and everything, so but we knew we'd suffered a devastating hit in a lot of casualties, but it took a lot of baths, saltwater baths, and a lot of healing and a lot of patience.
Yeah, where did that come from? You're a pretty young guy. You haven't been through a whole lot until this.
Well, you do what you have to do.
Did your parents know you were alive, or did that take a while?
No, they got a notice that I didn't make it, and then they got a notice that I did. But they sent us back to Mare Island Hospital and went through a lot of baths, a lot of skin grafts, a lot of time laying. They put us on a bunk and put a canopy over the top of us and covered the canopy with a blanket and put light bulbs in the canopy to keep us warm. Kept the burns open to the healing air. I wanted to go back into the Navy, so I went back after I was home for about a year, and my whole left side healed up really much from the medical discharge. So I re-enlisted and went back in, and they put me on I went to boot camp again because I hadn't caught up on my shots and stuff, and I went to island there in the bay, and they put me aboard a destroyer, DD-406 USS Stack. We headed for the South Pacific right away, and we were in on the invasion of the whole land in New Guinea and a couple of islands offshore there. And we went to Guadalcanal, picked up troops to put in the Philippines, and the lady, and we were in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and we were in the Battle of Luzon Gulf, and we led all the invasions in with the minesweeps, and finally Okinawa, and we were on pick of a patrol 300 miles north of Okinawa between there and Japan, and for the kamikazes coming down, and let them know down below that they were on their way, and that was kind of hazardous. We lost 5 ships one night there, and they sent me back to the States, and the war was over, and I had a game.
And I understand that you lived that, and that you've told your story many times. So that is, in a way, old hat to you. But you do understand how crazy that sounds to most people, right? That you were burned over the majority of your body. You still don't have any feeling in your fingers that you haven't had for 75 years. You're recovering for a year in the hospital. You've been medically discharged. But you sign up to go back, and you end up fighting the rest of the war. Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, it's just one of those things that happens, I guess. Felt like maybe I should be there, whatever happened, but that's the way it worked.
And the title of your book is All the Gallant Men, and you're honoring those who died December 7th and really the 406,000 Americans who died in the war. But it strikes me that just that action you took, I mean, you are the gallant man. Did you feel that you were doing something beyond what was asked of you?
No, the heroes were still out there.
Still on your ship.
Yeah.
What'd your parents think when you re-enlisted?
Well, actually, they didn't want me to go, but they said, if that's what you're made up your mind to do, it's your life to live. It's just the thing that surprise attacked and didn't get a chance to fight back too much, so was still in the same predicament. I loved the Navy, and I went back in.
Well, I'm sure you've heard a lot of people say a lot of things to you over the years, but I've interviewed close to 1,000 World War II veterans and many courageous, incredible men who blow me away with their stories. But just your story and what you just shared and your determination, that's really remarkable, sir.
Well, like I tell everybody, everybody had to be someplace.
Yeah.
And I was there.
Yes, he was. And we're thankful he's still with us today. Remember, you can pull up that entire interview at hometownheroesradio.com. But the update has to do with where Don Stratton was months after our interview. On July 21st of this year, this American hero visited our nation's capital for the very first time. And it wasn't a sightseeing trip, though he did take his wife of 67 years, Velma, along. Don and two other USS Arizona survivors accepted an invitation to the White House so they could push for a medal for Joe George, that sailor from the Vestal who tossed the rope and saved the lives of Don and other sailors that day. So I'm pretty sure you'll recognize this voice in the Oval Office on July 21st.
Lauren Brunner and Donald Stratton are also with us. They were on the deck of the USS Arizona doing their duty when the ship was engulfed by massive, massive flames. They were both fortunate enough to be rescued by another courageous hero, Joe George, whose daughter, Joanne, is with us today. Joe was in a boat next to the USS Arizona, and when he saw several men still standing, he hurled a rope onto the deck of the ship at tremendous risk to himself. Lauren and Don clung to that rope, and hand over hand, they crossed through the 70 feet of flames, burning endlessly. The story of Lauren and Don's devotion and duty doesn't end there. Despite suffering terrible burns, still with them today, they both served in the Navy for years after, fighting in some of the greatest Pacific engagements in World War II. Lauren and Don, thank you very much for your lifetime of service and your lifetime of sacrifice. Thank you very much.
So that, of course, was President Donald Trump in the Oval Office in July, honoring Don Stratton, two other USS Arizona survivors, and the late Joe George, who was never awarded a medal for his life-saving heroics because he disobeyed an order to leave the area. Don didn't get to talk to the president in private, but that brief public exchange does give him hope that the man who saved his life will be officially honored by our government someday. Also, while in Washington, Stratton and his fellow Arizona survivors laid a wreath at Arlington National Cemetery's Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, honoring the 1,177 men who died aboard their ship on December 7th, 1941. Their names, of course, are inscribed in marble at the USS Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor, where my travels just so happened to take me this weekend. I visited that hallowed ground with buses full of college football players, none of whom were born until more than 50 years after Pearl Harbor. But now they have a whole new understanding of the price that has been paid for our freedom. The USS Arizona Memorial has been visited by millions and millions. But until a few months ago, there was another of World War II's most famous ships whose wreckage had never been found. The USS Indianapolis was resting on the bottom of the Philippine Sea for more than 72 years until a crew commissioned by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen discovered it in August. In a few moments, you're going to hear the latest development for Adolfo Harpo Celaya, who survived the sinking of the Indianapolis and the tragic shark attacks in the nearly 4 days that followed before survivors were spotted. But first, I want you to hear just a few minutes of what Harpo shared here on Hometown Heroes about July 30th, 1945. The ship had just delivered components of the atomic bomb that would eventually end the war to the island of Tinian and was on its way back when the Indy was attacked by a Japanese submarine.
I had gone to sleep down there below, but I had my crew chief, which came down looking for me and came over and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Why don't we go up on top deck? Our watch goes from 4 to 8. He said, "We can wake each other up." And so I went with him, and there wasn't a place upstairs that you could lay on. It was all the sailors were upstairs because it was very hot. But I remember I always used to sleep with a blanket on. Everybody used to make fun of me because I did that, but I was got used to it, and my crew chief was laughing at when we went to bed, and that's where I was when they repeated it. The big explosion happened right where I was at. The thing that saved me was a blanket that I had on. You because when I woke up, there was no blanket. The fire had taken it off.
Were you burned at all?
I had burns on my legs and my hands were, I had my hands out, but my hair was almost all gone. My eyelashes were gone there then. So it was a pretty good sized blast, and it killed a lot of sailors around me. The only thing that saved me, I think, was the blanket.
Well, this was just 4 days after you guys had gotten to Tinian with that important cargo.
Yeah.
Of course, and you still didn't know what that was. But what a way to wake up with your hair burned off, your eyebrows burned off, the blanket blown off of you. And that ship, this huge cruiser with 1,200 men on board, sunk in just 12 minutes?
12 minutes.
What was that 12 minutes like for you?
Well, I ran to the back of it, and then that's where I met with my friend Santos Peña. I didn't have a life jacket. I didn't have anything with me. In fact, I only had my T-shirt and my shorts. I didn't have shoes. I have nothing. And I told Santos, I got to go down below, Santos, because I don't have a life jacket. And he said, you can't. He said, the ship is going down. I said, I just came from the front of it. He said, the whole front end is gone, he said. So I stayed with him. We both jumped off. When I hit the water, I hit something, and I thought I had hit Santos. And I thought I'd killed him, you know, so I didn't see Santos for 3 days. But after 3 days, we met up with another group, and here he was. I found him there. I saw the shark coming around. I mean, everybody would, when they say sharks, they start kicking and all that stuff. And I kind of stayed in the middle of everything, and except when I found Santos Peña, I went around and went over to look for him. But otherwise, they had nets hanging on there, but the nets were very rough on you because the ocean was pretty rough. So on the nets, I would get in between the nets and swim with it. So that helped me quite a bit, too.
And I imagine the day that you were rescued in August of 1945 has to be the greatest day of your life, because none of the rest of the days would have happened if that day didn't happen. How did they get you out of there, and how great did that feel?
It's kind of a dazed deal. I mean, because they come down with the landing barges to pick you up with a hook, you know, and put you up in the landing barge. And then when they took you right up next to the ship that was going to put you in, which the Bassett ocean was so rough that the landing barge was going up and down all the time. And so they had to put a kind of a hammock deal, you know, those deals that they put down, put you in there and tie you up, and then they haul you up to the top, you know. So I remember the sailors that took care of me, they were on this Bassett ship. Oh, they did a heck of a job. They gave me a little glass of water, probably about two swallows, and I told them, no, I said, want more? And no, you can't have it. So little by little, they got me back on.
They knew you couldn't handle that much. And yeah. I have to imagine you hadn't had anything to eat or drink for more than 3 days, right?
Oh, 4 days. Well, all the time I was there, I never had anything to eat or to drink.
So I imagine there had to be plenty of moments where you thought you were going to die.
I thought so. Yeah.
How did you keep hope alive? I mean, were you out there praying? Were you trying to talk to other people?
Everybody was praying, but I had them. Here in San Jose, my mother had gotten me a St. Anthony medal.
Mm-hmm.
And that medal that she gave me, I put it in my mouth. That medal stayed in my mouth all the time. I can remember that.
I want to get a sense of how tough it was for you to recover, because when your body goes through something like that, it does take a while to recover from those extreme circumstances. How long did it take you to get back to health?
About 4 months, three or four. I spent 3 months in Long Beach Naval Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays they call it something else, post-traumatic or whatever.
Post-traumatic stress disorder?
In those days, they called it, they said you were crazy or something like that, you know. they didn't bring up this the way they put it up now, you know.
Well, and if you heard Harpo's entire interview, and you can pull that up at hometownheroesradio.com, you know that he did struggle for quite a while to deal with the haunting effects of PTSD and what he had been through. You also know he returned to high school in his hometown of Florence, Arizona. He even led that school to an improbable upset in the state basketball tournament and was named the MVP when they won it all. And Florence, Arizona is where the latest development in Harpo's story unfolded in September of this year, when the post office in his hometown, thanks to an act of Congress, was officially named the Adolfo Harpo Celaya Post Office. It's time for our first break, but when this special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes continues, more updates to some of the most captivating stories our veterans shared with us this year. An Army nurse, a wounded infantryman, and an ex-prisoner of war are among the voices still to come. Make sure you thank the veterans in your life today, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Veterans Day edition of the program that hopes to remind you to treat every day like Veterans Day and give honor to those men and women who have risked their lives so we could be free. I did say men and women, and it's been a thrill over the years to be able to share with you some of the stories of the women of World War II. So many were helping the war effort on the home front as civilians, but there were plenty in uniform, too. I received an email recently from a loyal listener who could never remember hearing a female veteran on the show, and indeed it is pretty rare, but female World War II veterans are pretty rare. During that time, there were more than 50 men in uniform for every woman, and that ratio is reflected in the spectrum of veterans who've shared their stories here. But one very memorable story we heard in March of this year came from Leela Morrison of Windsor, Colorado. 7 decades ago, she was a young nurse from North Georgia who found herself living in a tent near the front lines during the Battle of the Bulge.
I wasn't fearful. I did jump a lot when the big guns went off, and our tent would go, you know, the roof of it.
Yeah.
And you'd just declare it was going to go off, but it never did. No, I didn't worry about that at all because I knew we were going to win the war.
How'd you know that?
Because we were a Christian nation, and I knew that God had a plan, and we were going to win the war.
What was the first taste of it, really, where you got a sense of what this was going to be like?
Well, when, as I say, we were in tents, that was real different, living in a tent. We were under pressure, it seemed like, because we got our hospital set up. We only took care of emergencies. If we received casualties that we thought would live until they got back behind in a station or general hospital, we sent them back. But if we thought they wouldn't live long enough to make it back, then we accepted them. Our first tent was a doctor and several Corps boys. Patients went in there first, and he assessed them, divided them if they thought they could go back or if we had. So my tent was right behind him, and that was shock and pre-op. And my job was to bring fellas out of shock. Then if they were going to do surgery, which most of them had to have, I got them ready for surgery. And I had several Corps boys in there with me, helping me. One of the biggest things we did, see, this was back in the 40s, we had no way of preserving whole blood, and that's what all the boys needed. They needed whole blood,
because
if they weren't hemorrhaging, they had been. So this plasma, blood plasma, is what we gave, and that was supposedly at that time the next thing best to whole blood. It was conducted into a powder, and then we had a bottle of sterile water, and we mixed those together and gave them IV as quickly as we could.
And just by the sheer numbers and the reality of what some of these wounds and injuries are, I mean, you're faced with a situation where a good number of these young men who you're trying to help, you know they're not going to make it.
Yes, you did. Unfortunately, that was true.
How hard was that to deal with?
That was hard, very hard, because they were all young. Some of them, I was 22, like I say, and I know some of them were younger than I was. I'm sure they cheated a little on their age if their parents would sign. Oh, some of them never shaved, you know, just real young. But they had a wonderful spirit, every one of them. They were there to win that war. They loved America. They were so thankful to be an American. And even when it meant, and of course, all of them knew any minute could be the last. But none of them ever complained or said, I'm sorry I came, or any of that.
And you said what your job was. How did that work? You know, I don't want to dwell on gory details or any of that, but so we have a perspective of some of what you saw. Can you give us a sense of what the condition of some of these guys were, why they were in your hospital, and what you guys hoped to do for them?
Well, in order to serve, you had to be in good health.
Well, and what I mean is the nature of the injuries that you saw. I mean, I'm sure you said before nothing could have prepared you for it. You saw guys missing limbs?
Yes, missing limbs. Shot, you know, with as many as we saw, I'd say almost every place. Before we got down on the front, we were with what was called DS, Detached Service, and we worked in those hospitals and took care of, chronically. And many, many of them lost their limbs from frostbite. They would say, well, we were down in this foxhole, and we were there for a week, and it was cold. That was in December. Of course, the foxhole had snow in it, and it would melt, and they'd have to stand there in the water maybe for several days. I remember one saying, my socks were all wet, my feet were so cold, but nobody had a warm pair of socks. So it lasted long enough that they did get frostbites.
Yeah.
And you know, they'd be so down when they lose a leg, or just so depressed. And you hate to tell them that their leg was gone, or maybe both. But before it was over, when they'd go back behind the lines, they'd be in a ward with others with the same thing. And before you knew it, they'd be having races out in the hall in their wheelchair, all of them laughing and adjusting. It was wonderful, wasn't it?
And in this war that claimed millions of lives worldwide and 406,000 American lives, your job was to save lives.
Yes, and it seemed so different, because we were the only ones there saving lives, or trying to, and everybody else was taking lives.
And you said that your job was to take them from shock to pre-op. You've got to try to keep them alive for that time period. And when you say bring them out of shock, how do you do that? What are you doing?
With the blood plasma.
So just their body's in physical shock. They can't function.
No. Many times they're passed out.
Yeah, so you can't talk to them, you can't encourage them in that situation. You're just trying to get life-saving plasma so they can make it till the surgeon can operate.
That's right.
That's pretty intense.
Yes, it is. It doesn't get much more intense than that. And we realized it. We knew that. And that's one reason I was so thankful to be there, because I know we saved lives. Of course, we lost a lot, but we saved some, too. That was encouraging to think that you could be there and have the little bit of knowledge it took to bring them out of that shock and get them on their way to recovery.
Did you ever feel like this was too much for you, that you couldn't handle it anymore?
No, I didn't. See, I was just there a year. Maybe if I'd have been there 3 years, it would have.
I think a lot of people, if they were there 3 days.
Well, that's true, but nursing school prepares you for that. And I think my background, being in the small town and being the bottom of 7 children, it helped me a lot.
Toughened you up a little bit?
Yes, I think so.
But you're in a war zone. You are on the front lines, and sometimes beyond the front lines. There were times where you guys actually set up and didn't know the area wasn't secure yet?
Well, 2 times. We crossed the Rhine River and went across on a pontoon bridge. I got over there, and of course, we called them GIs, you know, the soldiers.
Yeah.
Set the tents up and all. And they started doing that. And they sent word and said, no, get them back. This is too close. So we had to go back across the Rhine, and we waited a few days. Not more than 3. Then we crossed at Worms.
And some people are under the mistaken impression that if you are operating a hospital, even a field hospital, an evacuation hospital like you had, that you're somehow safe, that the enemy's not going to shoot you. I think you learned otherwise, didn't you?
Yes, you did. On all of our tents, we had a big Red Cross, great big one, and you could see that from the air. But As we got further down into France and Germany and some of those smaller countries, we were never bombed. They were the girls and lost lives down in Africa and Italy. See, we had the German Air Force pretty well knocked out by the time we got down in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had what they call Bed Check Charlie. You've heard of that?
Every night, right?
Mm-hmm. They'd fly over to see what we're doing. We were under complete blackout, which was a little tougher because you had to go outside the tent in a flip you there, you know.
Yeah.
Pull the curtain back. You tried to hurry because they told us how many feet up you could see that little light and to be very careful.
And so if they saw the light, Bed Check Charlie, this German bomber, yep, knows where to drop his bomb.
Yes, that's right. And we saw mostly the Air Force with the Silver Star, our U.S. What a good feeling that was. You'd see many of them, you know, big noise flying over.
I don't want to be melodramatic here, but living with this every day, I mean, from the severe weather, and you're in a tent during the Battle of the Bulge, and you can't take a shower, you can't stay warm. I know you're surrounded by people who are worse off than you are because you're treating them every day. But, I mean, you're just confronted with death on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Did you consider the possibility that you might die over there?
Yes, I did, because I knew some of the hospitals had been bombed. I don't know, mistake or what, but in a situation like that, it's easy to make a mistake. But, like I said, we were never bombed. The girls coming up through Africa and Italy, they were, and several of them were killed. But we weren't.
And tell me if this is true. Brad Hoops, who interviewed you here in northern Colorado, shared a little bit of your story with me. He told me that you were ready to die yourself.
I was.
You prayed that if there were nurses that were going to die, let it be you and not those who had a husband and
yes,
children.
I did, because I was young and single, and my siblings were all grown and on their own. And see, my mother and dad were both gone. So I just felt it would be so much easier for somebody like me to lose their life than some of those that had such ties at home. And we had boys, they sort of looked at us like a mother, a sister, aunt, and if we ever had time, they'd show us pictures they'd just gotten. And one that I particularly remembered showed me a snap of a little boy, 3 years old, and he said, "This is my little boy. I've never seen him."
Mm-hmm.
And where he lived and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the boys were, their spirit and their outlook was just tremendous. I can't say enough good about them.
And I'm sure you helped treat hundreds and hundreds of wounded soldiers. Can you still see some of their faces in your memory?
Every Memorial Day, every time I say the Pledge of Allegiance, every time anything real patriotic, yes, I see their faces. One thing that's uppermost, and I think of it so often, the freedom, the wonderful freedom that we have. We tend to take it for granted, and I probably would too if had I not had this experience. But I've seen, like at ball games and different places when they play the national anthem, you'd see the kids playing over here. I mean, high school kids. And that hurt.
Mm.
Or to see somebody burn our flag, that hurts. It really does. Because, the price was high. It was high. And I think of each one of those boys. They love to live. And they love their families. And they liked a nice home. And they liked to have enough to eat, just like you and I do, to experience life with all of its goodness and some badness. We all have that. And they didn't get to experience it anymore. Just cut off so short. But like I say, I never heard any of them complain or say, "Why me?" They all were willing. And stand a little straighter when they play the national anthem. I just stand stiff and tall. I can't straighten up anymore, but I try. And how thankful we are.
And how thankful we are to have met Lila Morrison. She would also go on to witness the horrors of the Buchenwald concentration camp. You can hear her memories of that at hometownheroesradio.com. But a couple months after we met Lila, she was one of three veterans honored at the Boulder, one of the biggest races in America with more than 50,000 runners. which culminates with a special Memorial Day tribute at the University of Colorado's Folsom Field. The Boulder Boulder produced a short video on Leela. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, along with info connected to the other voices you're hearing from today. Right now it's break time again, but when we come back, one of the men who received care from nurses like Leela, and one who knows the uncertainty of being a prisoner of war. This special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Veterans Day edition of the show, in which we're revisiting some of the more powerful stories shared on these airwaves this year and providing a few updates that show these amazing Americans aren't living in the past, but always do have something to look forward to as well. One thing I look forward to this time of year is the opportunity to connect our greatest generation with the latest generation, the teenagers of today, who, when you get their attention, hang on to every word these veterans share. I had the privilege earlier this week of visiting Fresno Christian School in Fresno, California for what has become an annual event. And the Purple Heart recipient I got to introduce to the young people this time was George Poplin, who recalled his experiences here on Hometown Heroes in August. George had initially received a deferment to help on the family's Oklahoma ranch while his mother battled breast cancer. But after her passing, he was drafted and, despite his severe asthma, was sent to Europe as a replacement, eventually assigned to the 2nd Infantry Division. His first taste of combat came in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge, and 45 days later, he was nearly killed by a German mortar shell.
On Christmas Eve, I went to the chaplain's service, and I promised the Lord that if I got home, I'd serve him the rest of my life. That took a while for that to catch on, but I finally caught on after I got home. When I got hit, I had on 2 overcoats and heavy gloves.
That was your standard?
It was that day. It's cold. I'd been on guard duty, and it was extra cold. And that shrapnel went right through there, half an inch layer, just took out bone and everything, nerves. And then on this other arm, it went through, took out the bone. So I had to have a bone graft, and it's broken.
So we understand. This was in the morning when this happened? And you and one other guy are standing next to each other?
Well, we're walking down to the Jeep with Mormite can in each hand.
Uh-huh.
That's what they brought the food in. It kept the food hot.
Right.
And it knocked me down.
Where did it hit in relation to where the two of you were?
It must have hit just in between us. We were not close together because you didn't dare do that. But as I went down, I lost my helmet down into a ditch. And I said to a couple of guys that were there, not ours, I didn't know them, I said, would you get my helmet for me? I lost it off in the ditch. And I was bleeding, of course, down the sleeves. And they said, you don't need a helmet. You need to get back to the aid station. They hailed a Jeep and got me back to the aid station.
What do you think would have happened to you if they didn't?
No telling. I'd have bled to death, probably.
So it lands between you, knocks you off your feet onto your stomach?
Yeah.
What did that feel like?
Well, it happens fast, you don't know.
You're kind of stunned and dazed?
It's just stunned.
Uh-huh. So it broke bones in your left hand, and that's bleeding.
And there was a little route across there, just a half inch deep.
So it took off the top of your hand.
When they went to do surgery, they scraped me all over, shaved me all over.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to hook up my hand to skin down here. When I woke up, my hand was like this and no skin. They had decided that they could press it back like that and sew it.
They bent your hand up,
yeah,
the wrist joint, and then stretched the skin to cover.
Yeah. My left arm was in a cast for 6 months.
And how about your right? Because it sounds like your right was pretty well.
For a year.
Was it shattered? Were all those bones shattered?
Yeah.
So you can't use either hand, either arm.
Not good. I'm down to 100% now, disabled.
And you had shrapnel in your backside, too.
Yeah, and it was just in the cheek. Didn't get to the bone, because I had the 2 overcoats on.
Yeah.
Time it got through them.
Were you in pain?
Yes. I didn't think I'd ever be able to use my hands much.
Yeah.
You know what I ended up doing?
Hmm.
Teaching typing.
Isn't that funny?
For 32 years.
So he was no stranger to high school students, and he was with some of them again this week. But until the end of that short presentation, most of the audience was unaware that three of George's great-grandsons, three of the 13 people who would have never been born if he didn't survive that horrific moment, were sitting right among them. All three of those great-grandsons are students there at Fresno Christian, which has an award-winning online student newspaper called The Feather. Mariana Fixie is a senior at the school who drew the assignment of writing about Mr. Poplin's visit.
Mr. Poplin was, it was really amazing to hear his story. I've actually known his family for quite a while, but I've never really been able to ask him about his experience in the war. So I really took away like how much a lot of these veterans sacrificed. He had to be away from his wife, who he had only married for 3 weeks. And so just to hear how much they had to really sacrifice, not even some of them, their lives, but also those who sacrificed their personal lives and their personal freedoms during the time they served. It was just really amazing to hear that point of view. I can't even imagine what it would be like to spend a year with both arms, you know, unable to use with cast on. So the fact that he kept a positive outlook while recovering from his injuries was amazing. And I can't believe that throughout the entire time he kept his faith and he kept his mentality that everything was going to be all right. And he just stayed positive, which was amazing. Every generation has had a different struggle, but to listen to the struggles of like this greatest generation, it's amazing. And I think really we have so much that we can learn from them. We have so much that we can learn from how they faced it with a positive attitude and how they just had this iconic American spirit not to give up and not to let these struggles overcome them.
That is Mariana Fixie, a senior at Fresno Christian High School. You can link to her report on George Poplin plus a few photos from that event at hometownheroesradio.com. And that brings us to our final veteran of the day, an ex-prisoner of war named Al Finley. You'll find him every Thursday at the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum in San Luis Obispo, California, where he volunteers as a docent. His 26th mission as a B-24 radio man with the 466th Bomb Group took place on February 6, 1945, and it would change his life forever.
And we'd been to the target and bombed Magdeburg, and we were on a return trip. We were flying over the Ruhr Valley. We flew through a flak shield. I don't think it was there all the time. I think it must have just started about the time we got there.
Oof.
Anyway, we got hit in number one engine and set it on fire. We were hit in the rear part of the aircraft. So I got out of my position. Wasn't far to between the pilot and co-pilot. I think our interphone was out the same way, the reason I did that. The engineer got out of it. He flew the Upper Martin turret, and he got out of the turret, and we were both standing by the pilot and the co-pilot, and the pilot said, "Bill, the engineer, go back to the rear and check the controls back there." He said, I can't control the airplane."
So maybe the cables to the rudder had been severed or damaged?
Yes.
Okay.
So Bill went back to the bomb bay and went back to the rear and gone a very short time, and he came back and said that the controls were cut. And also all three gunners had been wounded and they're in bad condition. And then he said, "I'm going to go back and take them." And I said, "Work over them, you know." And I said, "I'll go back with you too." And as I turned to go, the pilot grabbed my arm and said, "Al, start throwing everything over out of the bomb bay that you can. The flak suits, the flak helmets, even if you get your radios loose. But I can't hold the altitude." So I started doing that. And first thing I know, I look back up and the co-pilot was standing up, getting his parachute. And he said, "Bail out, bail out." So I grabbed my chute, and it was a chest chute, and hooked it on my chute. I took my GI boots that was beside me, and as I went out, I put them on the catwalk. Then I bailed out, and I left my shoes on the catwalk. But anyway, I was so low that we were so low that I saw two sheets come out after I went. I didn't see the airplane crash. I saw the airplane kind of climb and fall off, but I never did see it crash because when I hit the ground, I hit it so hard it knocked me out, and I was unconscious for I don't know how long laying there. And when I woke up, there were three German, I assume they were farmers, standing over me. Two of them had pitchforks, and the other one had a gun. Again, I was so kind of woozy, I didn't really know what was going on, you know. The one with the gun pointed at my head, you know, and I thought, I bought the farm, you know. And then he turned the gun away and fired it, and then started laughing. And then I must have passed out again, because the next thing I knew, I was in a farmhouse. One of them was there, and a woman was there, and somebody had taken my wristwatch and my dog tags. They'd gone through my clothes, you know. I tried to ask how I got there, and they showed me a wheelbarrow. They'd put me in a wheelbarrow and rolled me in a wheelbarrow to where it was. It was after dark when somebody came back with the police and took us to the local jail. I say us, it took me to the local jail, but the others were in the jail. There were the co-pilot and the navigator and the nose gunner. The pilot wasn't there because they didn't see his chute open, and he was loose in the country for about 2 weeks before he turned himself in. But there was the nose gunner and myself, the co-pilot, and the navigator.
So that's four of you there at that jail.
There was five of them. Well, yeah, four of us, that's right, because the pilot wasn't there. Okay, I'm trying to get five out of it.
Well, and the math, so everybody listening understands, you had nine men on the plane.
The Bombardier wasn't flying then, because what they had done was take the nose gunner, and as the lead aircraft would drop their bombs, he would toggle the bomb. So we lost the Bombardier, really.
So you've got a nine-man crew.
Yes.
And you talked about the three gunners in the back being wounded.
Yes.
They all went down with the plane?
They all went down with the plane, plus the engineer went down with the plane, and there was nothing wrong. He got caught back there.
He was back trying to help them.
That's right.
And it cost him his
life. So nobody knows how bad they were injured or what was going on in the rear of the aircraft, but Bill, the engineer, and he went down.
Did you guys know that at the time? That they had not survived?
Well, we'd known that they'd gone. We didn't know that, but assumed the airplane crashed. We didn't know they'd be killed. We didn't know that till the Germans told us.
You mentioned how hard you hit the ground because you had to bail out at such low altitude.
Yes, yes.
You hit it so hard it knocked you unconscious. Did you have injuries as a result of that?
Just my back, the lower part of my back. It was hard. It was hard for me to sit down, so I hurt the lower part, tailbone or something.
But when you find yourself at this jail and you see some familiar faces, yes. That had to mean a lot to you to see them.
That's right, yes. My navigator, Rock Kramer, could understand a little German, but he didn't let them know that he understood German, you know. But anyway, he told us, he said, don't say anything about Magdeburg. He said, one of these fellows has got a mother or something that lives in where we just bombed, you know. Ooh. So he said, don't say anything about Magdeburg.
Yeah, and you can laugh about it now, but at the time, right. I'm sure there was a real fear that these people could kill you.
Yes, there was a real fear, yes.
But he survived the next 3 months as a prisoner of war, despite being trapped in a train car while American and British planes were shooting it up, despite moving from prison camp to prison camp while suffering from malnutrition with very little to eat. At one point, he even had to march 100 miles from one camp to another. His POW experience is something he never talked about. Even those he served with throughout 29 years in the Air Force never knew he'd been a prisoner. But one thing Al could never get out of his head was that final mission.
I felt kind of guilty all my life now since that I came so close. If it hadn't been for the pilot, I wouldn't be here. I came so close to going back there with Bill. I say it was a step away from death, you know.
So when Bill went back to help the wounded gunners, you were going to go with him, but pilot said, you need to start jettisoning stuff and making this plane lighter.
That's right. That's right.
But if he hadn't said that, you would have gone.
I would have gone. I'd taken one step to go when he grabbed my hand. So I was that close to death.
And you would have gone down with the plane.
Sure, yeah. Everything happened so fast, you know. You didn't have really time to think, you know. He's gone back. Nobody knows how the three in the rear were, you, other than he. He went back the first to check the cables, and he's found them wounded. And then he came forward and told us, and then we went right back again. And he was the only one on the crew that was married and had a child. It just
so when you say you felt guilty,
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I think I hear you saying is that sometimes you wish you would have gone back and Bill would have survived.
So, yes. When the pilot came in to camp and we saw him again, he didn't really know that all of them had been killed, you know. And so that broke him up too, you know. And he said that he was going to put Bill in for a medal when he got back to the States, because he should have got the Medal of Honor, really, back there tending to them, and gave his life doing that, you know.
Yeah.
I've never known where he got a medal or not, you know. Like I say, I've had a guilty feeling ever since that happened. Maybe I shouldn't have, but I just couldn't get rid of it, you know. And I think when I got those plaques, I had a plaque put up on the wall about 2 years ago.
And we're talking right here where we're sitting at the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum. So there's a wall near the entrance with all these plaques that list the names of different servicemen. So you had your name put up there.
I had my name put up and my service up, yes.
So that'll be here long after you're gone.
That's right, that's right.
But then you had another idea.
Yes, I did. I decided that to get plaques for each one of those and have them positioned where each one touched my plaque, and that we would be back together again after 70-some years. And that's happened, and I think a big relief has been taken off of my shoulders for doing that.
And you'll find photos of that and other elements of Al's story at hometownheroesradio.com, but here's the more important postscript. I told you when we first brought you Al's story in September that we had just been able to connect him with a nephew of Bill Fowler, that engineer who went down with the plane. That was the first contact Al had ever had with the family. And now I'm thankful to report that 72 years after that tragic mission, Al Finley is now in contact with not only Bill Fowler's daughter, but his now 90-year-old widow as well. Bill was posthumously awarded the Purple Heart, but never any other decoration to recognize the selfless act that cost him his life. Al Finley has written down his account of the mission, and together with Bill's family and hopefully some help from Congress, he is determined to see his late friend properly recognized. So what's the moral of our story on this Veterans Day? I'm sure you've drawn some of your own conclusions by now, but one thing I hope you glean from these five amazing veterans from around our great nation today is that as long as they're living, it's never too late. Never too late to listen to their stories. Never too late to honor them. Never too late to connect them to people they never thought they'd have the chance to meet. And let's all remember that on Veterans Day and every day, it's never too late to say thank you. That's our program for today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org.
sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.